And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Don H. from San Diego.
My name is Don. I'm an alcoholic. It's beautiful to be here. Madeline, thank you. And Linda, thank you for your message and powerful story about forgiveness. Congratulations to Peggy Rose and Gary and Chris. Particularly thank you, Peggy Rose, for showing up 31 years later and carrying the message still. I'm grateful there were people in the meetings that had 10 and 20 years when I got to meetings. I remember those people. I don't remember anything they said, but you were there. I want to thank Larry for asking me to do this. You know, he asked me this in July, and he's like, "Well, what about September 24th?" I'm like, "Well, sure." You know, I mean, I don't know about tomorrow, but sure, September. And it's amazing how it comes, and you know, it's amazing between what happened in July and what happened today. You know, just in 3 months, how much life changes, and how beautiful it is that today life can change instead of being the exact same thing over and over and over. You know, so I hope to get into some of that. But I have to tell you, I was driving here. Anthony's like, you know, what's going on? And I was thinking about the first time I got asked to speak, which I felt was much too late. As far, you know, I was a year sober when they finally asked. And I had been waiting. But I was asked to speak in Indianapolis. I was at a training at Fort Bend at the time. I was in the military. And, you know, I was so worried. I was 13 months sober, 12-ish. And I got the full plan, nights, weekends, the whole deal. So, so this guy asked me to speak, and I'm like, yeah, I'd like to do that. And I was so concerned, I was so worried about not being enough. I mean, I was so overwhelmed with this need to make sure that you knew that I belonged here, because at the time I was 22 years old, I had gotten sober at 21, and I was so worried that I just didn't qualify. I mean, I knew I qualified. I wasn't confused about what had happened with my drinking, but I just spent an hour talking about the drinking. You know, I mean, my fraternity wouldn't let me drink, which I didn't know the fraternity could do, but apparently you can get kicked out for drinking. And, you know, I just went through every rotten thing I'd done drunk. And afterward, the message that I got over and over and over was, boy, I'm glad you're not drinking anymore. You know, I mean, I was like, me too. But afterward, days later, of course we do the review. I got the committee and they all were running it through the ballots and making votes. And, well, I just didn't do it right. I didn't do it enough. It was wrong. The message was wrong. I was off. I lived in six cities in my first 2 years of sobriety, including going over for the Gulf War, which was a while ago. And I was stationed again over in Virginia at the time, and I was asked to speak at Fort Monroe, and I spoke there, and this time I prepared. I mean, I was ready, and I had a message, and my speech was a list of exactly how I went through all the 12 steps, which, in and own, you know, I was just very compelled to make sure you knew that I qualified, you know, and if I could help somebody along the way, it was very important. You know what I love about old timers? I got to tell you, what I love is that laugh, just that low. It's not loud, but it's continuous. You can be talking about the things that went wrong. You can talk about what went wrong. The best is the plans. Oh, I'm going to get married. I'm going to move. I have to say, one of my very most favorite things in the world is a newcomer with a plan. Please, tell me your plan. I love a newcomer with a plan. So I had prepared, and I had my notes. In fact, I still have the notes. I archive. I don't scrapbook, but I archive. I went through all the 12 steps, and there's a guy on the East Coast, like Ken D does his deal out here, and thank God for Ken's message. But there's a guy out there named Hollis, and he was a priest, a Catholic priest, till he got married. Then he was an Episcopal priest. But anyway, so Hollis was a guy who was a regular at this Fort Monroe meeting, and I saw him there, and I was very, very, very intrigued and interested in what Hollis would have to say about my speech. My talk. And so I went up and I asked. Yeah, bad idea. You know, he said, you had a lot of information, a lot of good AA information. And then he took his finger out, and you got to be worried when an AA takes their finger out, and you got to be more worried when the Al-Anon takes their finger out. But he said, it'll be really something when that information moves from here, and he poked my head, to here, and he poked my chest. So, we'll see. It's been 21 years since then. We'll see what happens. You tell me. So this is the deal. I was also thinking on the way out here about drinking. I grew up in a family of drinkers, and I just one of the things I talked about, this distance between what happened since July to today, and one of the things that happened was I found out that I'm insulin resistant, that I'm pre-diabetic, that I had metabolic syndrome, and I got that information, and it was a shock to me because I didn't know. But the doctor diagnosed me, and so he's like, "You do this diet, and you'll change." And I did the diet, and I lost 30 pounds in nearly 30 days. I mean, about 5 weeks, I'd lost 30 pounds of weight just from changing how I was eating. And a lot of that had to do with my pancreas not working, and insulin not working, and about my blood not working, about my organs not working. And I find, so I go home in August, and I'm talking to my dad, who is an alcoholic from a long line of alcoholics. My grandfather died at 50. My uncle died at 49. My other uncle, who had just gotten sober a couple years before, died at 48. So alcoholism runs in my family, and it turns out my dad's diabetic never told me that his grandmother died of diabetes, that his aunt's legs were amputated, and she died at 50 of diabetes. It's sort of like where the gene pool turns into a swamp, I guess. Things didn't function. But the great thing, the thing that's so different today was I went there with the intention of talking to my dad and my mom about the past, and I found out some really powerful stories and some powerful factors that influenced their life. And Linda talked about this dynamic with her dad and her brother. I got to tell you, one of the biggest problems that I had was nobody ever loved me the way I wanted them to. Nobody ever did. And nobody ever loved me the way I thought they were supposed to. Although my mom did. my mom loves me a lot. But my dad loves me more, I think. But I didn't understand that when I was 12. Because I was weird. I was different. I was really a kooky kid. And kids and parents, adults would come up and say, "You're really different." And I'd say, "Thank you." Because I thought that was a compliment. I was doing everything I could to be different. I didn't know. And all I knew was whatever everybody else was doing was the last thing I was going to do. I had no interest in doing what everyone else was doing because everyone else was doing it. Why would I want to do that? I'm going to do whatever you're not doing. And I didn't understand where that came from. I didn't understand about not fitting in. And I also didn't understand when I got my first, I had a, my first year that I got real Christmas presents. I was 12. And I got all the things I asked for albums, and I got them. I got Diana Ross's Greatest Hits, Donna Summer's Greatest Hits, the YMCA, Village People Cruising. I got Barry Manilow, Gladys Knight and the Pips, and Marvin Gaye. Because I'm from Detroit, So the deal is that, I was in the I was in my room, and I'd listen to Diana Ross and sing, and then I went to junior high, And at this time I started drinking. We would drink in my house. My parents felt like it was better to have, you know, the kids drinking in the house than not drinking in the house. And plus my dad really, my brother, was drinking with my dad. So we would go out to the liquor stores and buy booze. You know, at 13, 14, 15 years old, on Fridays, I would go get a pint of Old Taylor, Old Granddad, Kessler's, you know, and then I went to Lauder's, a little fancier. But I was drinking scotch and whiskey at, you know, a pint at 14 years old, 15 years old. And then I would, you know, drinking did something for me that just nothing else did. It made, and more than make, at that time, it wasn't about a party, which it did later. But at that time, I mean, I would take my brother's pornography, my mom's cigarettes, and my pint, and I'd go to the bathroom, and I'd smoke cigarettes and drink the whiskey and, you know, look at the porn. And this is being taped, but Terry said my story doesn't change. You know, the story didn't change. What happened was, and then I'd go down for dinner, and I'd feel even. I'd feel like I could sit at the table and not freak out, because I just felt like something was wrong. And there was nothing wrong, but what was different was, you know, at 13, 14, 15 years old, I started to have feelings about being attracted to guys, and that was just so not anything I was going to have happen. I was from a very traditional conservative Republican house in a very traditional conservative Republican city, and there was just nothing I knew that was gay other than people being called faggot in the hallway, period. And I was not interested in being that person. You know, this weekend, today, 5 days ago, there was a guy named Jamie Rottemeyer who was 14 years old in Buffalo, New York, who killed himself because he was bullied for being gay. You know, his funeral was today. And I don't know what it was, but there was a small spark in me that resisted. It resisted 15 years of trying to be crushed and drowned and smushed and disregarded and stuffed down and hidden and repressed. I mean, I did everything I possibly could not to be gay. And there were times when I was 21 that I thought about killing myself because of the depression and all the way things cycled, and I'll get there. But the point is that I didn't have the courage to come out at 14. I didn't have the courage to come out at 22. I didn't have the courage to come out until I was 28 years old, after being in the military and after playing rugby and after being in the fraternity, the chugging, whatever it was that I thought was masculine or manly, I did to try to hide from myself. So today, if I have any message at all to anybody, the message I have is be yourself. That's it. Find the courage to be yourself. Now, the problem is I came here and I had no idea who I was, and I knew that I didn't want to be who I was anyway. I had ideas about who I thought I was, and I had ideas about who I thought I was supposed to be. And sometimes when I had achievements, I got scholarships or I won awards or I had success, you know, those things would feel like they came close. But the idea of who I thought I was never met up with the idea of who I thought I was supposed to be. And I spent years, and in between that distance, between who I think I am and who I think I'm supposed to be, in between that's my suffering. And the farther those things would be apart, the more I would suffer inside. And the closer they'd be, the less I'd suffer. But there was always suffering. I suffered. I suffered because I had a mind that just judged and condemned and thought this should be different and this is wrong, and if it were this way, it's not like it's supposed to be. I mean, in fact, I was arguing a couple years ago with my sponsor about the situation at work that I was very, very adamantly, you know, it was wrong. What was happening was wrong. The decisions that were being made by the superintendent, the people were wrong. And I said, this is supposed to be different. It's just supposed to be different. And he's looked at me and he said, Don, if it was supposed to be different, it'd be different. I'm like, no, you don't understand. This should be different. He said, no, you don't understand. If it were supposed to be different, it'd be different. It's not different. It's exactly like it is. Oh. That's good. Yeah, that's why I got a guy that like that for my sponsor. I couldn't see it. I could barely see it two or three years ago. I certainly couldn't see it when I was 16 or 18 or 20, drunk, you know, as drunk as I could get to try to forget who I was, that drunk, drinking out of a funnel for 14 hours drunk. Sweet. And but so the point is that, you know, I had to find this way. And at first, what I tried to do is, I think like everyone tries to do, is bring these things together, bring this who I think I am and who I think I'm supposed to be. And I'd start changing who the supposed to be is, and I start changing who the think I am is, and I try to jam them together. It was impossible. You know, and thank God I went and got outside help. Thank God that the pain and the suffering, my fear, that my, you know, that this spark, this desire to stay alive and not just live, but this desire to fulfill my truth, to live, the desire I got in AA, that to be myself. Because I saw people here. I remember the first meeting I went to. Well, I won't get there. I'll start talking about the time I wiped shit on everybody at a party instead. That's a four-letter word. Poop. My brother went to the Naval Academy in 1980, and you know, as my dad said, he set the gold standard for the family. And you know, my sister went to Harvard and got a Harvard MBA, but my brother set the standard. And I was so mixed, you know, like as Linda said, you know, I had this resentment and frustration, and I love and a respect and an awe. You know, my older brother is my older brother, and he was doing things that just, you know, but he had all of my dad's attention. And you know, what happened growing up is that by the time, you know, my dad was a drinker, and he never missed a day of work, and he functioned really well, and he loved his family, and he's dedicated his life to raising four of the most amazing people. I mean, my family is really powerful, and I'm grateful to be part of that. I'm grateful for my family. But there was a period during, you know, I was actually, during my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, my sisters and brothers and I threw them a party. There were like 300 people. It was a big deal. It was really cool. And there were years where I was sitting with my mom when I first got sober, and she was in Al-Anon, and my dad's drinking was at its worst, where I'd sit with her and say, you know, we'd be at pizza after the meeting, and I'd say, well, I just don't understand why you don't leave. He is crazy, and this is horrible. He's a jerk. He's just a jerk. And she'd say, well, you didn't know him before he drank. You weren't there during the good times. I said, I don't know. And there was an interesting part in a story by Augustine Burroughs. You know, he talks about his older brother and how his older brother had different parents than he did, even though they were the same parents, because of the things that happened in the years that preceded. And that's what happened, because in 1975, you know, I told you that my dad's father had died when he was 14, and his older brother was the one that raised him. And Floyd was just a tremendous salt of the earth kind of guy, my Uncle Floyd. And but when he passed away in 1975, in October, something happened, and my dad, he had turned 40, and things just snapped, and his drinking escalated like it was just really. And for the next 10 years, things were really, really tough in my family. And so I was at this party with my mom, you know, and there was a point, you know, when the party's going and you kind of pull back, and I'm sitting with my mom, who I love. I mean, she's amazing. And I'm sitting there, and she's like, you know, I said, 50 years. Same person, 50 years. Not just that person for 50 years. She goes, you know, there were only 20 bad ones. I said, I think those are the 20 I was there for. anyway, so the deal is that, you know, 76 happens, and my dad's drinking's going haywire. And, you know, my mom starts locking him out of the house. She's, you know, there's the arguing, the fighting, the things being, you know, stuff being thrown against the wall at night and laying in bed and just not knowing. And then having to put that face on and go to school and pretend like, you know, I mean, our family was a family in the neighborhood that people looked up to. We were achievers. We, you know, and I wasn't going to talk about any of that. I wasn't going to, I mean, nothing got talked about. We didn't talk about anything. You know, I just didn't talk about that kind of stuff, because you don't. No, I remember the first Al-Anon meeting I went to, and I sat and listened to these people talk about their families. And I just thought, all that was going through my mind is, you need to shut up. You don't talk about that. You need to shut up. so, you know, things happen. When my brother left in 1980, 4 years later, my dad really got remorseful and morose and self-pity and sad because his drinking buddy, his best friend, his oldest son had left. And, you know, and I just felt like a penny waiting for change. I just felt like there was something wrong with me. And I had felt like that since I was 5, but I really felt like that at 15. And, at 16, and when my brother came home that first time, they threw this giant party for him. I mean, you know, and the whole time my dad and when I was 15 years old and I started growing my hair, which is what 15-year-olds do, after they learn how to spit. And, so I'm spitting and I'm growing my hair. And, I went to junior high. And I realized within the first week, if I showed anybody my YMCA or my Donna Summer albums, I was going to be in trouble. So, I also like Ted Nugent, and I like AC/DC, and I like Aerosmith. And I found that's much more palatable to the average junior high kid. So, you know, Zeppelin and Aerosmith it is. And within a matter of a 2-year period, all that kind of openness and questioning and, that period that isn't even about sexuality, but just about changing and developing, I just got smushed. And at 13, 14, I was very clear, heavy metal, that's me. And to be heavy metal, got to grow your hair. So I started growing my hair. And, my dad, of course, being didn't like my hair being long. And, he said one day, how long are you going to grow your hair? And there's, till it hits my ass, with a couple extra things in there. Because that's how he and I talked to each other. Because I was a disrespectful, hurt, scared, angry, frustrated, and ungrateful, really. I didn't get it. I didn't appreciate it. I didn't appreciate what he had gone through, where he had been, and I didn't appreciate the things that he provided me. And I was very focused on what he didn't do, And that grew. And I was very determined to get out of the house. But at 16, that summer, I mean, literally, I didn't realize this until much later, but the gay man's favorite holiday is Halloween. And the mothers out there with gay kids are like, it's true. They know. Anyway, I didn't know that at 16... But I'm like, okay. And so at 16, but the thing was I would start planning my costumes, way in advance. I had that stuff dialed in like August. And I'm not kidding. And in August, I was downstairs and I was in the laundry room and my brother had left some of these laundry bags from the Naval Academy and I had picked one up to look at it. And in the moment, and this is something that I didn't recognize until just a couple years ago, that I held the bag up and then I put it against myself and I just knew. I like immediately went, oh, perfect. And I ran upstairs and I grabbed my dad's shoe polish. I grabbed this brown stocking cap out of all the winter clothes that we kept in boxes. And then I went to Kmart on my bike and I got a pair of long johns and I got some tie-dye and I made my costume, and I was super excited because when I showed up, now at this point by 16, I have now, I was fat, I lost the weight, I had glasses, I got contacts. At 16, all of a sudden I had moved into my house and I just, downstairs in the basement, I was coming in and out of the back, out of the side door, and I just had no interaction with my family or my dad, and I was just so done with trying to be part of it. But it's, and I thought because I moved away that then I wasn't part of it. But if you're in a house of an alcoholic, you're part of it. Trying to be not part of it is part of it, I'm not thinking of pink elephants right now. You got a pink elephant. So the deal is that my grades had improved, and what had happened is that as long as I put my grades on the breadboard, my dad would leave the money, and that was our interaction. We had nothing to say to each other. I just had nothing to say to this guy, and I just felt like I wasn't who he wanted me to be. I wasn't the right son, I wasn't the right anything, I wasn't Charlie, I'm just not
I'm not enough. And of course, my little brother wanted to be just like my older brother. So those two guys are good to go, and I'm just SOL, you know, penny waiting for change. So I, you know, but I got my costume, so that's good. So October, you know, and by this point, I'm drinking a fifth. And I'm, you know, I think about this now. At 16 years old, it's abnormal to get a 64-ounce, 2-liter bottle, pour out half of it, pour in a fifth of rum, and have that be your one drink, you know, for the night. But that's what I did, and I did it every weekend. That's how I drank. And I could, and I never barfed. I mean, I never threw up. I never, you know, I was fine. I'd do anything I was, you know, needed to do. So I show up at my friend, and I'd also made a little sign. So I got my I got my brown long johns on. I made my face brown. I got my dollop of my hat, and it went over like this. And I cinched that laundry bag at my neck, and it said "bag of shit" right on the sign. I had no idea the psychological, you know, ramifications of like comparing myself to my brother, but it was like played out, you know, virtual or real reality. So I go to this party and I'm the dance, you know, and I love it. I mean, I'm so happy. You know, I finally found something that fit. And, so I'm dancing around and, you know, I'll tell you, at 16, I go to this party and the door opens and Duran Duran's playing and I'm, you know, hungry like the wolf and I start doing the bag of shit dance and, oh, it, things are funny, but they're even funnier when you're dressed like a bag of shit. So I've got all the crowd's attention, and it is like perfect. I mean, I'm drunk the right amount. I've got the right amount of attention. You know, I've got a fresh cigarette lit. I'm just, it couldn't be better. It just, I mean, you know those peak moments, the ones you shoot for. Well, the thing is that the next moment the door opened, and this is 1984, the thing at that time that was going on are the Chippendales, right? And the three hottest guys in school, the door opens, and they're in red bikini spangly things and cuffs and things like this. And now several things happened. Several things happened. One thing that happened is all the attention that was my attention went to the Chippendales, because people would rather watch Chippendales dance than a bag of shit. The other thing that happened was that my attention went to the Chippendales dancers as well. And that really, really scared me, frightened me, angered me. And in just a flash, I was just like, I was in this judgment about, immediately I walked through the crowd, I dropped down because I realized, you know, I just put my head down and I walked through the crowd. I went to the fridge and grabbed a six-pack of Heineken, I don't know whose it was, and I went to the back to the picnic table. It was cold, and I'm sitting, and the ground's kind of frozen because it's October in Detroit, and I'm sitting on the picnic table, and I light a cigarette, and I'm just thinking, I'm not enough. This is, you know, this is funny. It's not funny enough. And if I had been funnier, people wouldn't have looked at them. And within a matter of moments, I've moved from my attraction or any of that. I've just moved that way over there. I'm distracted, and it's all about judging myself. And I start thinking about, you know, what I got to do differently. And then, I'm drinking one beer, two beers. I finished the fifth beer, and I'm feeling a little more confident, and I'm ready to go back in. I just got to do it right. I got to have an entrance. And then I look down, and there's a pile of dog crap on the lawn. And I'm like, exactly. That's what I thought. I'm lucky. So I grab the crap, and I go back into the party, and I just start wiping dog crap on people. And then make my way through the crowd and leave. And I drank for five more years. I guess it's like this. You know how you feel like when you drink, you feel like you're 6'5", 250 pounds? Well, that's where I start. I just really, and I had no regard for myself. I had no regard for you. I just didn't really care, quite honestly. I wanted to care. I should care. I don't care. I just don't. What I care about is not being me. I care about not feeling this. I care about things being different. I just care about what's happening here is not enough. And I'm not enough. And that was just a constant theme of what was ever happening. My grades weren't enough, whatever. So the opportunity to get out of the house and go to California happened. At 18, I got a scholarship in the military. And again, this is before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So it's a dishonorable discharge. Well, that's nothing to worry about because that's not anything I'm doing. So, but that pressure's there. And I go to school and, I join a fraternity because they drink. And I missed the sign. There's three signs in America. There's one on the in California on the 10. There's one above Texas and one in Florida. It says, this state does not work either. I missed that sign. So I got to California and nothing changed, I thought I'd be away from my dad. I thought this, I'd be myself. I wouldn't have had to bring my history. Well, I brought myself. And I also brought my progressive chronic fatal illness. Because that's what I've got. I've come to understand alcoholism is a progressive chronic fatal situation. It gets worse over time, never better. It's not going away and it'll kill me. And progressive, to me, means that my drinking was fun, then it was fun with problems, and then it's problems. And once the problems start and the fun stops, it never goes backwards. And I've been in AA for 23 years, and I have never heard anyone talk about, my fourth DUI, and my kids left, and then last night I went out and I saw Slash, and we partied, and it was awesome. It doesn't happen. Fun with problems, problems. And that's what happened to me, and I was, and even though I had left, I'd still gotten a scholarship in mathematics because my dad said, you can't major in art or history. You got to get, you got to do something you make a living at. So, all of us majored in engineering and math and economics. And, so I'm failing out of school. Apparently you have to go to class I'd much rather. I can mark the drinking. My drinking progressed from Friday, Saturday night to Friday, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon to Thursday, Friday, Saturday night to Sunday afternoon to Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon. And then Monday night, there was a pub party. The only times I showered or shaved by the end was in order to go to the military and put my uniform on once a week. That's when I shaved and showered. Otherwise, I was drinking. And, my grades dropped but more importantly, mentally, I really started to come unglued. I really started to get depressed and frustrated about the what had happened because it was only 3 or 4 or 5 years ago that I was successful and I could hold it together and things were working, but it had gotten to the point where I couldn't. It had gotten to the point where no matter what I did, I just couldn't bring it together. I got selected to be a resident advisor, which was a paid position with the university, and so I was part of. There was a centennial celebration, the 100 years of the college. I didn't realize at the time that it wasn't a party for me, but it was actually a party for the donors for the university that had been there for 100 years, and they were trying to raise money, and they had this brand new pool facility. And I'll tell you how naive I was. I was at a party where there was unlimited shrimp. I mean, I had never been at. There was a table full of a pile of ice and shrimp. I had never seen anything like, and free beer. So I'm at this party with the president of the university and all the donors and all these people, and they introduced the 20 of us at one blink, and then they said, go do your thing. So I'm like, right, I'm in a suit, so I'm just by the shrimp, just banging that thing away. I mean, I like destroyed half a big fraction of this thing, and every time a guy with the beer would pass, I'd grab one and throw it down and wash the shrimp and eat some more shrimp and drink some more beer. And and I'm thinking, this party's good, but it could be better. And it was at this new pool facility, so it's lit up, and it's really nice, and the lights are under the pool, and I'm thinking, it's perfect. So I take my shoes off, and I go over to the 3 meter board, I run and just belly smack her right in the middle of the pool and splash water, and... And as I'm swimming over to the side, I just remember thinking to myself, I should have taken my wallet out. I was dumb. Why didn't you take your wallet out? Now everything's wet. You just don't think about anything. What's your problem? I'm not thinking about the dean of residential life who's staring me down and looking at me like I'm a crazy person, or all the donors who are like, did someone die? Is there someone accidentally fall into the pool? Is there, do we need to call 911? What is going on? None of that. All I'm thinking is why I didn't even do that right, as if there's a right way to do it. The next day, I got called into the dean's office. You know what he said? He said the first AA aphorism I've ever heard, although it wasn't an AA aphorism. He said, "Don, perceptions are realities until proven otherwise." Do you understand what I mean, Don? Perceptions are realities until proven otherwise. Oh, of course, I said, "Oh yeah, I know. But the thing is, I had already, what happens growing up in an alcoholic home, you get like X-Man powers. You know, it sucks. It sucks. The silence sucks. The chaos sucks. The changing rules suck. The not knowing what's going to happen next sucks. All that sucks. But what doesn't suck is getting your X-Man powers of being raised in an alcoholic home. At 8 years old, I could tell, I would open the door, and I could see my dad drank at the kitchen table, which had the view of every single room in the house. You couldn't go in any entrance or exit in anywhere. There was a door. Anywhere you went, there were, he had view of everything. And I knew that I could sit, and I would open the door enough to see his leg, because he would cross his legs when he drank, and the more agitated he got, the higher his knee would bounce. And I could tell, like a meter, it was like a barometer, like where the weather was, like how high the, you know, is it just here, you know, you could run through the kitchen, it won't be a problem, you know, or is it just like agitated, and, you know, if it's, you know, because there are days you just close the door and it's like I'm going over to my friend's house. I'm not, whatever I'm not doing is going in that house. I'm not going in there. It's wrong. And to grow up like that and not know, to not understand that that's not how it is, I didn't know. But I had that power, you know, and I brought it with me. I got it today. I can see who likes me, who doesn't, who, you know. I don't know, I'm so worried about it anymore. However, at that time, I walked into the dean's office, and he looked at me, and I could tell in the look that I was in trouble, but I kept my job. You know, you can tell in an instant whether, you know, it's really bad and he's going to fire you, or it's not so bad and it's, you're going to get talked to, but you're... So I had already relaxed. I had relaxed when he... So his, you know, your perceptions are proven. You know, the weird part is I had no idea what it meant then, but I remembered it because we said it so many times. You know, it stuck up. Perceptions are realities until proven otherwise. You know... Okay, I got that, but it didn't matter to me. It didn't connect. It didn't matter when I interviewed for the job the next year and the first thing they asked me was, "Do you think you're an alcoholic?" No, you know, no, I'm not an alcoholic. You know, I remember I took a friend of mine who was a drinker. I brought him to the hospital with a 0.43 alcohol. The next day, yeah, that's bad. He comes out 3 days later, he was still pruned. And I sat him down a couple days later because I was concerned about his drinking, and I told him that, you know, I said, "You got to do something other than drink." And then he said, "What the hell are you talking about? We drink together every night. You're with me every night. What else am I supposed to do?" Well, I went to my RA, you know, I sat there and I'm like, "Hold on a minute." And I remembered a list. I went to the RA handbook and I opened it up. I was like, archery, badminton, chess. I had no idea. I didn't know what to do other than drink. It's what we did. But they wanted him to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, so I agreed to go with him. And I went to this Wednesday noon meeting, and it was a small meeting. It was a meeting where there was only like 10 or 12 people. People were there at lunch. And the one thing that was there was a guy who I knew who drank like I did. I wasn't friends with Eric, but I was really good friends with George, his roommate. So I knew Eric partied like George did, and I partied with George. And so he was someone I trusted, and he had disappeared, and he was back. But I didn't know he was back until I went to this AA meeting. He was the secretary of the meeting. Turns out he'd gone to rehab. It was his fifth year senior. His parents had a lot of money. And he had a bad cocaine problem. And now he's back. And he's got 60 days. And he's secretary in this meeting. And he's shiny-faced and super happy to see me. And I'm freaked out because I have no idea what this is about. I mean, I walked into an AA meeting with no idea, nothing. I don't know. And then they start going around. "My name's Pete, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Joe." And it gets to me, and I said, "Well, my name's Don, and I'm here with my friend Paul." And it gets to Paul, and he says, "My name's Paul, and I'm here with my friend Don." And I think, "You little SOB, you're the one that got in trouble, not me." And then it goes all the way around. Now, I told you I was fat, and I was really overweight when I was a kid, and I have judgments about myself. Like, and I'm sure for all the newcomers out there, please judge away, and just don't forget to put your name on the top of your four-step when you're done. So, came around to this guy who I had been sitting there just ripping apart in my head. He was a big guy, and he was... He did construction, but he was like a maintenance guy, and he had this John on his thing, and he's got this sandwich, and I'm just thinking, fat effer this and mother effer that, and so I'm just running through my head, and I'm like, who is this guy? He's eating in front of everybody. He didn't even put his sandwich down when he said his name. He goes, my name's John, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to know why these two guys that aren't alcoholics are wasting their time at an AA meeting. He took another bite of his sandwich. I was like, oh, I'm here to help my friend Paul. I drank for 2 more months. I ended up in the hospital. I ended up doing things drunk that I'd never do sober, that I told myself I wasn't going to do again and again. I repeatedly did things drunk that I wouldn't do. And then one day, after the accumulation of days upon days upon days of all the things we know, I came to a day where I was so out of control, and I scared myself. I couldn't, and I'll tell you, and we actually went back to that president's, that meeting there with the Curtis Rooks. What happened was that spring, he had a luncheon deal, and I knew not to drink the free beer for the luncheon. I knew it. I did not want to do that, and so I didn't drink for that hour, which was a deal. But I made up for it for the next 3 days, right, treating myself for what a great job I did and not drinking for that hour. Well, when it all come down, and it was the lowest day of my life, and I'm really busted, and I go to, I'm 3 days, I'm just depressed and in my bed, and I finally, I've got to get on with my life. I had picked up the phone, I had had the yellow pages, and I tried to call AA, and I could not dial the number. I threw the phone down, I hucked the yellow pages across the wall, and I went back to bed. Finally, 3 days later, I get up, I go to class, which apparently I had attended the class I didn't even have. I didn't know it until later. But so I go into this class, and I'm walking up this spiral staircase, and I hear this voice, hey, big guy, how's it going? And I literally have to look up and over, and it's that guy, Eric, standing at the top of the stairs. And I said, things are not going well at all. I mean, it's bad. I didn't tell him I'd been thinking about killing myself all weekend because I couldn't control myself and I was afraid I couldn't drink and I couldn't not drink and I didn't know what to do, and I'd spent some time in a park and I'd gotten on my knees and I said, God, please help me. And I didn't say, God, please help me stop drinking, because I didn't even understand that was my problem. I just said, God, please help me, because I can't go on another minute like I'm living. I can't drink, I can't not drink, and I don't know what to do. And I laid in bed for 3 days, and the first guy I ran into was this guy, Eric, who had 60 days, a meeting schedule, and a car. And he reached out to me, and he said, how's it going? I said, not so good. And he said, are you going to one of those meetings? He said, I'm going to it tonight. I said, would you take me? He said, yeah. That was November 6, 1988, and I haven't drank since. I've seen people here that are 16 years old, 20 years old. And I tell you, a lot happens between 21 and 44. A lot happens. And one of the things that happened was, I remember 6 months into the deal, watching a guy get a 24-year cake, sitting there thinking, what would it be like? What would my life be like? I remember distinctly, what would my life be like if I was 20 years sober? I'd be 42. What would that be like? And, if I had written it down and did my dream sheet, not in a million years would I ever imagine that I'd have a career that I love, that I'd have a partnership with my boyfriend that I love, that I would have friends and family connections that I love, but mostly that all the judgment, all the condemnation, all that constant running of my mind, to be free of that. To be free. To be able to look people in the eye instead of looking at their shoes. To not wake up with a row of crows on my bed. I had so much that I couldn't have dreamed of, because I didn't even knew it was existed. How do you, tell someone to write down your... You don't know. You have no idea. But this is the great thing. The day I got my 20-year chip, my mom had come in. I threw myself a party. I had a friend fly out from France to come to my party. Yeah, I'm Francie. So that morning, I'm sitting in the meeting waiting for my token, and I start thinking about that when I was 22, and when I was thinking about that guy getting the cake, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, you know, if I stay sober 20 years, I'll be 62. What would my life be like? I have no idea. I couldn't imagine. But what I do know is I've never, ever seen anybody stay sober and regret it. And I can tell you, I've sponsored a lot of people and have been to lots of meetings where people come back, and I'm grateful they're there, and they're grateful they're there, but they sure didn't have a good time while they were out. So on behalf of, I guess the thing for me is that to give back a fraction of what was given to me for so long, free. People coming up, and, you know, I'll end with this, because it really is this. People said, you know, we'll love you till you can love yourself. And I'd go to these meetings, in Detroit even. You know, they even say that there. We'll love you till you can love yourself. I'm 6 months sober. I'm crazy. I'm hanging out with bulimic teenage girls and 80-year-old ladies. That's my crowd. I'd gone to a meeting, this men's meeting in Indianapolis called the Cold Nickel Group, and it's still there. I actually got an email from a guy who's, they just put on a speaker thing, a 3-day thing, but the Cold Nickel Group at that time, Wednesday meeting, and I'm at this meeting, and this, you know, this old timer at the end of the meeting, like any newcomer, I throw my hands down, I start running for the door, and this old guy just steps in front of me, and he says, "You're new here, aren't you?" Yeah, I'm like, yeah, I'm new. What? And he says, "You know the name of this group?" I said, "No, I don't know the name of the group." He goes, "This group is the Cold Nickel Group of Alcoholics Anonymous." Okay, old man, I don't care what the name of the group. I just want to go. I have a coffee and cigarette outside. Don't leave me alone. He said, "Do you know why this group?" And old people are slow. Old people in AA are intentionally slow. So he says, "You know why this meeting's called the Cold Nickel Group Alcoholics Anonymous?" And at this point, I had surrendered that moment. I said, "No, I do not know. Why is this meeting called the Cold Nickel Group?" He said, "Because Alcoholics Anonymous is the million-dollar education shoved up your ass, one cold nickel at a time." And then he stepped aside. So I'm in this clubhouse in Detroit, and this whole thing, "Oh, we'll love you till you can love yourself." And I'm like, what is that, you know, stick that in your ear. What does that even mean? "We love you." I don't want you to love me. I don't want you. We'll give you the dignity you deserve till you can give that dignity to yourself. We'll hang out with you. We'll feed you till you can feed yourself. We'll be with you till you can be with yourself. That's what AA gave me and has given me every single day. And I was in that same clubhouse. I'm walking down the hall, and this big lady with a big flowery dress and a big floppy hat and the big purse and the big book in it, and you know her. She's here. She's everywhere. Anytime you get 200 of them together is one of them. "I'm Betty, and I'm a miracle today, and you're a miracle." And I was just like, you know, frozen, just like, "Oh, don't touch me, don't hug me, don't see, you know, it's weird, don't see me until I'm ready to, you know, do something, and then hi." Anyway, I'm frozen in the hallway. She's got her floppy hat and her perfume, and she says, and she's been around, she recognizes it, she stops. She just stops. She's like, "Oh, you're new." "I'm new. How'd you know?" She said, "Honey," she leans in real close. She goes, "Honey, I got good news and bad news. The good news is there's help, and the bad news is it's us." Larry, thank you. Thank you very much.